You have to see a picture of yourself there, Dave.
Okay. Historian of science David Kaiser is our friend and colleague in SPS here at MIT, where he also holds a position as lecturer in physics. His first book, Drawing Theories Apart, The Dispersion of Feynman Diagrams in Post-War Physics, is a study of pedagogy and visual culture in physics. And fittingly, Feynman diagrams are themselves tools for thinking about unseen realms of elementary particles. Dave Kaiser is also author of the forthcoming How Hippies Saved Physics, Science Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival, as well as numerous edited volumes in the history of physical science. And most recently, he is editor of Becoming MIT, Moments of Decision, to mark the 150th anniversary of this institution on which many of us depend.
Thanks so much. I want to thank both the organizers and the conveners. I understand those are separate groups. I want to thank everyone involved. I also want to thank the main speakers today, Kim Fortune and Sarah Igo. Before I go any further, I want to implore all of you in the room, anyone who might be listening in podcast land, to immediately, without question, order three copies of Sarah's book, Kim's too, actually, but Sarah's book, which I know well, buy three copies, share them with friends. It's that good. So anyway, I'm especially pleased to be able to talk with you today about some of Sarah's most recent work. The session title for today was on measuring, the unaccounted colon measuring, I think. So that's good. So I got that right so far. And so I want to step back a bit from these talks, these very juicy and detailed talks, and think about this notion, this category of measurement, which seems to be sort of motivating and behind much of what we've been hearing about today. Oh, this isn't plugged in. Sarah repeated this. My understanding is that the conveners put this out to the main participants, and it sounded so good I wanted to encase it in marble, or at least make it look like I had. And they wrote that, quote, measurement is one way to bring unseen phenomena into discourse, that which is invisible and that which is as yet unvisualized, that which is unrepresented and that which is perhaps unrepresentable. And I think we've seen, you know, myriad ways in which that has been at play in toxicity, in making up publics in a kind of mass surveying sort of sense. What I want to do is come back to this notion of measurement that's been organizing us today and sit with that notion for a little while. Most of, I think, what we've been talking about so far has been taking one precursor portion of measurement, and that is rendering legible or visible, making the unseen seen or the unsensed sensible. And I think that's sort of the zeroth step of measurement, but measurement, at least as a category, as an ambition, an ideal, if not always or rarely in practice. Measurement involves more than just rendering visible. And so if you do, as I did, for example, in a hurry yesterday morning, Google something like measuring instruments, you get pictures like this. And what's going on with this, you know, collage, other than bringing back perhaps bad memories for many in the room? There's more. These instruments certainly are geared, if imperfectly, to reveal the otherwise unseen. But they have built into them an ambition, again, not always a deliverable or a delivery, but ambition for some sort of accuracy, and also separately, I think, for precision, but for accuracy, for getting it right as an ideal. And that often in these involves a comparison to some standard, which therefore has to have been both established and circulated around to make that seem as if something that anyone could in principle compare with. And then a possibility, a promise for some sort of error correction, for tackling and grasping what's wrong, as well as just rendering visible. And so I want to sit with this notion of measurement with these notions in mind to say, is measurement in fact more than only rendering visible? And what else might that notion do for us as we think about these examples? So if you go back to the Oxford English Dictionary, you'll see that the word measure in the English language has a very long history. It goes back to the 14th century, if these folks of the OED are to be believed. Obviously, Shakespeare's play Measure for Measure making clear use of the verb to measure. And yet the noun measurement is actually much more recent. It dates really from the middle to late 18th century. And again, it has built into this notion of standard units. There is not only rendering visible, but somehow accounting for it with relation to something else. That immediately, therefore, brings to mind standards, norms, and deviation, whether it's the Kinsey Report or an ohm meter, equally titillating topics for some. And I think here, we could, if for those keeping score at home, we can score one for Foucault. I mean, this is indeed a high enlightenment project he's cheering on here. that this is that measurement already implies something not only of rendering visible, but indeed of having the projection of what with respect to what is one being measured. And so measurement as an activity or as a noun is indeed much more recent vintage than just to measure. And it seems to have built into it these added notions beyond just legibility. Again, just a very brief survey. Some of my favorite books that I happen to have on hand. There's a very, very flourishing literature now on what historians often call metrology, the making and prosecution of standards, we might say. Again, a literature that Sarah knows well as well, has contributed to. And part of why these books can be so thrilling is because, again, what's going on here is not only rendering visible, that's step zero, but indeed all the fight, what's at stake is whose standard, according to whom, circulated in what manner, and toward what ends. And so if you think about, say, the metric system, always a hot topic, for example, in the United States, it's more than just rendering a visible meter stick or kilogram weight, but according to whom, according to whose standards, with what stakes at play. So again, I think we can look to a very broad literature on metrology or standardization. Similarly with statistics, again, a literature to which Sarah has contributed quite a lot already. Why do these still hold such power? I think often to the detriment. I'm not here to celebrate the power they seem to hold. But they've held this power not forever, really, for in recent vintage in world historical terms. And again, not only for making legible, not only for, say, apprehending a whole, thereby sort of making a whole, the nation, the imagined community, for collating things that seem to be separate into one place. They do that, one way of doing that. But they also hold out the promise, the ambition, the ideal of sort of disciplining error. Think about these error bars with, say, chi-squared, least squares analysis and all these things. It's not just to render legible, but to try to, again, hold out the promise, often betrayed in practice, and we now all know how to lie with statistics. But I think part of the rhetorical and political persuasiveness is beyond legibility. It's this notion of capturing and hopefully disciplining error. So now when we move to this topic of privacy, which Sarah is laying out for us very compellingly, again, I think we have a number of moving parts that might not all be the same, and I think we get different notions into the conversation by teasing some of these apart. So anyone, I won't ask for a show of hands, anyone who's ever had to grapple with the IRS or indeed, say, a private credit report when you go to buy something, they say you can't afford it. Anyone who's ever been mistakenly placed on a do not fly list, I have a very cherubic faced friend who can't fly without waiting an extra half hour in line because someone else has a similar name. He swears it's not him. I think what we have to worry about in the era of databases and bureaucracy and these massive unending file cabinets, whether paper or digital, is not only the surveillance, the sort of Orwellian seeing into what is the big brother overwatching all, but the problem that once something gets in there, right or wrong, it sort of never comes out, right? And again, I won't talk about personal experience, but the concern with measurement and error and the hope for error correction is more than just saying I have a piece of paper that says such and such. And so are there axes along which to consider the privacy debacle or debate beyond the Orwellian legibility or surveillance, but also more like when you wake up in a sort of novel by Kafka or by Joseph Heller, is that there's sort of the breakdown of reason, there's sort of total lack of a kind of self-correction that one can get tied up in. Sarah has gestured towards a kind of longer 20th century view in the United States, where this comes to a head in the 1970s. I think the examples to which she pointed make perfect sense. Of course, again, many in the room will know it doesn't start there. Sarah points to the 1930s. Of course, we have the immediate post-World War II era of McCarthyism. This, again, is combining and I think often conflating two distinct topics and concern. One is, yes, indeed, as we now know, thoroughly illegal surveillance, often with totally illegal wiretapping and invasions of privacy and so on, and data being collected and put into files. Another problem, which some historians have begun to pick apart, is the fact that these things are not self-correcting. In fact, they're often not correcting at all. So some sort of trivially obvious misstatement of fact gets in, and these files never get purged. You just can watch the cascade of error through these often, you know, dizzyingly thick, partially redacted FBI files through things like the Freedom of Information Act, itself a product of the period that Sarah's describing. Again, a lot more can be said about that, but there's the failure of measurement, or at least the failure of the promise of measurement, no sort of notion of error correction, for lack of a better term, which is compounding this sort of eerie legibility. If I were either more savvy or far better caffeinated, but unfortunately, both are false. If either of those were true, I would then have a nice reflection on reflexivity and recursiveness in what's to follow. Instead, I'm just going to tell you what's been bugging me for quite a long time, so bear with me. Here's a quick example to get across what I have in mind. There is a very well-established historian, many in the room will in fact know, named David Kaiser, who teaches nearby in Rhode Island at the Naval War College. He, among other activities, publishes lots and lots of books. He also maintains a blog. It's called History Unfolding. And it's a sort of a reflection on current events from a kind of a political historian's perspective. He's made very clear what his views are. It's not hard to figure out where he stands on various issues. I think he writes often very well. And attached to his blog was this kind of simple bio. You know it's not me. It says David Kaiser is a respected historian. That should have been the first tip-off. He's been maintaining the blog since, I think, 2004. It's a long time. By now, a long time. What happened soon after the recent presidential election was that someone was deeply upset by the outcome and decided to write what can charitably be called a factually errant rant, comparing, which is now sort of not surprising anymore, it was shocking to me, but comparing Barack Obama to mostly to Adolf Hitler, plus other people that the author didn't like also. And then to make sure this had some sort of cachet and would circulate in a certain way, this anonymous author of this blog post cut and pasted the bio of David Kaiser from the Naval War College, who a well-established historian and blogger, pasted that onto this essay, which was not written by David Kaiser, and then it took off. Now, until very recently, the Naval War College did not maintain an online directory, so you can all figure out what happens next. So someone gets this curious essay, and they say, oh, I want to go contact the author, mostly to say you didn't go far enough. Almost never to say, do you know anything about Nazi Germany or... So usually, it's 98% of the time, is to complain that the author has not, in fact, gone far enough, or asking if they could reprint this essay in their local newspaper, or yes, or what else, where can I sign up for the new militia? They Google the name of the author, or the alleged author, who's not dead, and bingo, they find MIT's very public websites. And so these are the emails I've been receiving, only the ones that actually come in, I'm sure rather undersampling in a kind of Gallup poll sort of way, a couple hundred. Now, they start percolating with my or his name on it, take your pick, in a few months after the election, after the inauguration. Within weeks, the error has been covered both by Snopes.com, which I'd never heard of until this came up, but supposedly those who are digitally savvy would immediately know, oh, Snopes.com. The Chronicle of Higher Education, equally unknown in certain circles. Other online venues had immediately tried to tamp this down. No, of course, it's trivially obvious it doesn't represent the blogger David Kaiser's views. His views are politically often, you know, quite distinct, and he's made no secret of that. Let alone the fact that the bio, which has been inappropriately pasted on, says this person is, you know, was born in 1947 and teaches at the Naval War College, and yet you've just gone to the MIT website and emailed me yet again, right? So that happens in early and mid-April 2009, and as one might expect, the rate then goes down until it doesn't go down, until it explodes again. This thing will not die. Again, podcast listeners, I'm sure it's the same audience listening to this podcast, please don't email me anymore. So at its peak in September 2009, we're up to between one and two emails a day, including weekends. I don't even respond to my grad students that often. This is ridiculous. Something the room will know. And then again, it dies down. It comes up again now to 1 to 2 per week in the run-up to the midterm elections. My personal favorite comes actually just a few weeks ago, just right before the election, when I often call him the other David Kaiser and I were commiserating. He said, the only thing that's surprising is it took this long, is that someone else who was writing for a blog called Project N Search, We Must Stop the NWO Banksters, that's New World Order for those who aren't practiced conspiracy theorists. And this author has very generously tried to give credit to the essay that he then reposts on the blog, very eagerly wants to give someone named David Kaiser credit. So he reprints David Kaiser, the blogger bio, and then reprints my bio from my website, and then decides to put my smiling face up on a size that I've never seen it that big on the computer screen. It was thrilling. And this is all happening, you know, long after the supposed debunking that should have, that one might have expected would have had this sort of error correction, which is, say, roughly a year and a half later. Thank you for letting me vent. That's my reflexivity. But I hope it's in the service of something. This is the last slide. When we come to think about privacy through this notion of measurement, which seems, as I suggested, to include more than just legibility, that's a zeroth order prerequisite, but something about the ambition for error correction, for getting things right, not just making things visible, then I think we have a reason to wonder about the future of privacy along more than one axis. And again, I think this is very much in line with what Sarah has been saying. There had once been a notion that the internet would be a wonderful place for playing and performing personae, something like what our own Sherry Turkle wrote about so marvelously a decade and a half ago, for example, and captured even more succinctly by this New Yorker cartoon, on the internet, nobody knows your dog. And instead, we have sort of way too much stuff that's laying in a cloud and will never get out. And so the concern with privacy might be not only that some faceless government bureaucrat or some corporate flunky could call up on her laptop at one keystroke all of our sort of personal data and information. That's one concern, a kind of, we might call that concern subclass Orwell. But there's also the concern that some 13-year-old with an iPhone just will continue with all the responsibility that phrase implies, right? With all the kind of fact-checking and measurement credentials that might entail, could be, further upon further kind of blasting out there things that have no clear relation to that which purportedly is being measured. And so are threats to privacy, in fact, coming from a failure of measurement and not only from its overactive use? And I'll stop there. Thank you.